we've been talking about salvation and how salvation seems to be defined by I hesitate to call it a point in time. It's defined by a transition point. And we talked about Romans, the sixth chapter and verse 17, where the apostle says this: thanks be to God that though you used to be slaves to sin, you have come to obey from the heart the pattern of teaching that has now claimed your allegiance. You have been set free from sin and have become slaves to righteousness. So because we all had this sin problem and we had to find a way to be set free from sin, that's the important point at which salvation comes to us. That's the point that we're trying to understand as we consider these things. Now here in Romans 6, there's another idea that I want to pursue with you tonight. He says, and I'm reading from the New International Translation, thanks be to God that though you used to be slaves to sin, you have come to obey from your heart the pattern of teaching that has now claimed your allegiance. This form of doctrine or this pattern of teaching, it's a phrase that is translated differently in different translations. The NIV, the CSV, the Christian Standard Bible, the Holman Christian Standard Bible, the Berean Literal Bible, all of those translations, and they tend to be newer translations, use this phrase, pattern of teaching. The English Standard Bible says it's a standard of teaching. The Berean Study Bible and the New American Standard call it a form of teaching. The King James calls it a form of doctrine. The Contemporary English Version, which perhaps is the easiest one for folks to read, says it's an example that was set forth in the teaching you received. So there's something about the teaching that's important. It's the form or it's the pattern. It's a word when we talk about the form of the teaching, this word form it's a word that the Apostle Paul uses to refer to people who are a pattern for others. It's really an interesting word. Look at 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, and he uses this word at verse 6. He's of course, talking about the Israelites, and he's saying that they were an example for us. Now, not necessarily a good example, but he says these things in verse 6, he says these things occurred as examples. So it was a pattern, a tutor. That's the word. He says these things occurred as examples, all the bad things that happened to the Israelites as they were wandering in the wilderness, to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things like they did. So it's a word that at its root means an example. Philippians, the third chapter, he uses the term again. Of course, here in Philippians, he's talking about himself. And again, how he can be an example to other people. Philippians, the second chapter, and at verse 17, he says, join together in following my example, brothers and sisters, just as you have us as a model keep your eyes on those who live as we do. So when he talks about this form of teaching, this is the word that he uses. 1 Thessalonians, the first chapter, and verse 7, he says, you, and of course he's talking to the Thessalonians, and there he's commenting on their faith. He says, you became a model to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. So there are models, sometimes good models, sometimes bad models. There are models that we almost put on a pedestal, like we do the Apostle Paul. And then in a certain sense, we're all models for one another. 1 Thessalonians 3 at verse 9, he says it this way. We thank God for you in return for all the joy that we have in the presence of our God because of you. So he's talking about the way that they live inspires him. So not only do we inspire other people, but you know, sometimes we inspire people that are, that we think of as really not needing much inspiration. It's amazing that the Apostle Paul can take some inspiration from what he could see in other people. And Paul is not one that I think of as really needing a model. 1 Timothy, the fourth chapter, and now at verse 12, this is what Paul writes to Timothy. Don't let anyone look down on you because you're young, but set an example for the believers in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, and in purity. So it's not just the old modeling for the young. The young sometimes model for the old, and there are a great many ways in which we can learn something by looking at the intensity with which our younger Christian friends worship God and do the things that serve God. In Titus, the second chapter, and at verse 7, the apostle says, in everything, he's writing to Titus, he says, in everything, set them an example by doing what's good. Now, in Romans, the fifth chapter, he uses this same word. Here in Romans 5, it's a little bit different. Romans 5 at verse 14, this is what he has to say. Death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a commandment as Adam did, who is a pattern of the one to come. In this way, the Apostle Paul is using this word to refer to someone who is a type. And we'll talk a little bit more about type in just a minute. But the apostle uses this word to refer to Adam as somehow bearing some of the characteristics that were true of Jesus. So it's not that he's just an example that shows us how to break law, but he is also a type of Jesus, showing us some of the essential characteristics that we're going to be able to see in Jesus. This is a word that's used a lot in secular Koine Greek. Now we've kind of looked at the way that the word is translated. We've looked at the different ways that the Apostle Paul uses this word. But in secular usage, this word had two slightly different meanings. The first one is to refer to a mark that was made by pressure or impact, and then it became a mold or a pattern or an example. Then it became the copy of the pattern. And then it became that which was cast from the mold. I don't know if you've ever seen the way that they make brass bells, but they take a sand form that's in the shape of the bell, and they pour molten brass into the top of the form, and it fills the form. Then when it's cooled, they break all the sand away, and instead of having the mold, they now have the brass bell. So this is, if I was to use the word in that way, I think what I would be saying is that the Roman Christians had received some teaching that served as a mold, and they were poured into that mold, and they became something very special by being poured into that mold. That there's something really interesting. If you look at the Revised Standard Translation, one of the newer translations, by the way, as they keep finding more and more of the original manuscripts, then they begin to have a better picture of what the original might have said. Even though there are a lot of errors that creep into copying, when you have a lot of copies, eventually you can get to the point that you're really sure that you understand what the original said. And we've been talking about that. We'll continue to talk about that in the canon class. But the Revised Standard Translation kind of reinforces this idea that it's a mold, and we're poured into that mold, and we become exactly what that mold was. Interestingly, in the Revised Standard Translation here in Romans, the 6th chapter, it says that this is a form whereunto we were delivered. Now, that's a little bit different than the way that it reads in the King James or some of the older translations. It makes it sound like we were here, the doctrine was brought to us. The Revised Standard makes it seem like the mold was here, and we were brought to the mold. So there may be a sense in which this is a pretty good illustration of obeying from the heart a form of doctrine. Now, there's a second way that this word is used in secular usage. I don't find I may find it used this way in biblical usage to refer to the New Testament. But in secular usage, this word very often talked about a general outline or general picture that gives us the distinguishing characteristics of a thing. And the way that I've tried to illustrate that is you're familiar with the AKC and how they set down certain guidelines for certain dog breeds. And if they were describing a golden retriever, they would say he has a head that looks just like that one. Doesn't mean that the head was a mold and the new dog was poured into it, but the general characteristics of this breed are these. And so you would talk about it as being a golden retriever type of head. And, you know, we clearly understand that happens a lot when we talk about the general characteristics of a thing. Have you ever seen a mutt and you try to figure out what kind of dog it is, and somebody will say, well, he's got a lab head. Well, what do they mean? Has the general characteristics of a lab. So if this was the way that the Apostle Paul was using the word here in Romans 6, it would indicate that there was a teaching that had been given to the Roman Christians that had certain well-defined characteristics. And it's distinguished from other kinds of teaching that they had heard that may have come from Jews, that may have come from heathens, because the thing that they had obeyed, the teaching that they had obeyed, had a certain kind of characteristic, and nothing else has that. Now, as you'll see as we continue to go through this, I tend to think that this is the way that the apostle used it, because Paul's gospel was a definite body of teaching. What Paul taught in Rome was the same thing that he taught in Galatia and in Ephesus and in Corinth. And I think Ralph said it very well this morning. In short, Jesus Christ and him crucified. That's the gospel. He taught it everywhere. And more than just saying it was Jesus Christ and him crucified, what that means is that there's a certain mold or pattern for conduct and character that the Apostle Paul is referencing. The pattern for conduct and character that Paul always talked about was Jesus. You remember, sometimes he said, follow me, but he said, follow me as I follow Christ. So you've got this second thought, which is that the teaching is a mold for pattern or pattern for conduct and character. And then finally, what you learn from Romans 6 is that this mold, this pattern, this kind of teaching, any teaching that has this characteristic demands wholehearted obedience. You know, I heard somebody that was talking about these three ideas. And he said, imagine, if you will, that there are three people standing at the foot of the cross, and they all watch Jesus be crucified. The Roman soldier looks at it and he says, yep, this guy got what he deserved. Now, I'm not talking about the Roman soldier that said, surely this was the Son of God. But most of the Roman soldiers that were standing there, no doubt, said this man got what he deserved. Then there were the women who were at the foot of the cross. No doubt Jesus' mother said, he's never done anything wrong. Why did this happen to him? And then you've got John, who's at the foot of the cross. He sees exactly the same facts, and John says, I've got to respond to that. That's the kind of teaching that Jesus' death was. When the Apostle Paul says, I have a definite body of teaching, that's not to say that what I'm teaching is certain theological principles and everybody has to adhere to those theological principles. When I taught statistics, I taught that there were certain things that always had to be true. If you multiply a positive by a positive, you get a positive. If you multiply a positive by a negative, you get a negative. Square something, it's always going to be a positive because you're multiplying a negative by a negative. Those are not theological, but just simple statements of fact, and you have to accept them. They're always going to be true. What Jesus or what Paul taught about Jesus was not a set of propositions. It was a history of deeds that were actually done. You know, when Jesus came, he didn't come to just talk to men about God and say to them what his apostles said after he left. God is love. He lived and he died. And that was his teaching about God. Jesus didn't just come to men and lay down a theory of atonement or a theory of propitiation. And unfortunately, when we talk about the cross, we sometimes reduce it to a theory of atonement or as you might say, I'm doing it tonight, we reduce it to a theology that relates to sin and how sin interrupts our relationship with God. Jesus went to the cross, and that was his teaching about sacrifice. So there's a fact, but then there's something much deeper than the fact. Jesus didn't just say to people, there is a future life, and it's like this. He came out of the grave, and he said, touch me, handle me. A spirit doesn't have flesh and bones. That's the way Jesus talked. It was the fact, but more than that, it was what that fact meant. So Paul's gospel was a definite body of teaching, just like Jesus was a definite teacher, but it was more than just principles. The second thing that I mentioned was that this teaching that the Apostle Paul did became a teaching about a pattern for my conduct and my character. Jesus is the type. He's the first one. He's the forerunner. What that means is somebody just walked past the building, if you heard that chime sound, and I have forgotten to mute my telephone, so I use that chime sound kind of like a doorbell. Somebody walked past the building, and that's what it tells me. So Jesus is the forerunner. He's the type. Everybody that comes to him is going to look like him. Not precisely. Not in the case of a mold and a casting, but he's the type. And if you look like Jesus, you look at him, you can look at me and say, yep, that guy looks like Jesus. There's something distinctive about him. The gospel, the way it's presented in Scripture, gives us three really important things. And they're all built into what Paul says here in Romans 16. We have the perfect mold, the perfect type. We have the perfect motive to become like him. And it gives us the perfect power to be able to do that in our lives. All of these three things give what the Apostle Paul taught its distinctive glory. Apart from what other systems of thought could teach. And there were other systems of thought, and those systems of thought purported to teach men how they should live, how they should mold their character. But what Paul taught was absolutely different. It was different in its type. Now, This is where it really comes together. This teaching that the Apostle Paul did, the form of doctrine or the pattern of teaching or the type of teaching that the Apostle Paul did demands wholehearted obedience. It can't be anything less. If this teaching was nothing but a teaching about abstract truths, it would be enough to give assent to them. If I'm talking to you about statistics, you don't have to live your life a certain way because a square of a number is always positive. You can just say, okay, Dean, I believe you. A square of a number is always positive. But you don't have to live your life a certain way. All that's required is you give assent to what I've just said. Now, this teaching about Jesus, you can decide whether or not you believe that this is true. You can decide whether or not to let Jesus come into your mind, but if you do let him in, he will always be the master of your life. There is no such thing as believing in God and not obeying it. That's because of the distinctive character of the teaching that they received there in Romans. And it's the same way today. If you let Jesus, if you believe it, you have to live it. That's just the nature of the thing. It's not like a lot of other stuff you can believe, but you don't have to do anything about it. With Jesus, if you believe it, you have to do it. You have to obey him. And that's why he says, here in Romans, the sixth chapter, you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered unto you, and being then made free from sin, you became servants of righteousness. Well, I've chewed up a bunch of our time tonight, so let me ask if there are any comments or questions or things that you could add to our discussion. Hey, remember, we're using the Corinthian model. You have to unmute and just go ahead and speak up.
I said there's an anti-type also, isn't there? There's a type and an anti-type, which would be different than the type. If you were acting like Jesus, and you would be type like Jesus, but if you're acting not like Christ, you would be anti.
No, that's not the way that type and anti-type works. If Jesus is the type, okay, and you are behaving like him, then you are the anti-type. It's not to say that you are anti the type.
Oh, okay.
You are the anti-type. So the type would be, let's say the type would be the Old Testament Jewish practices of meeting in the temple. And the antitype today is like the type, but today it's Christians who come together to worship. So the type and the antitype, that's always been confusing to me too, Jimmy. It always seemed like when you talked about the antitype that you were talking about something that was against the type, but that's not it. Yeah, it's type and antitype. I wish there was a different way to describe that other than that word, because that word gets us a little
critical. Yeah, because it means against. Anti is against something.
Right. That word means, we think of that word as meaning against the type. Really, it means it follows the type.
Okay.
Well, what would you call what many in our head think is thought was the anti-type, which is Satan? So what would you call one that rejects the
mold? Not following in the pattern of the type. That's a person who just rejects the type. Yeah, you're right, Carol. It's one of those unfortunate words that doesn't mean what it seems like it ought to mean.
It has two meanings.
Go ahead, Ted.
Yeah, it has two meanings. Antitype means a person or thing that represents the opposite of someone or something. And then the second meaning of antitype is something that is represented by a symbol. So that's the dictionary definition of the word antitype. And you could see that Adam was the antitype of Christ, in that he was, or I guess a better example was that the flood was the antitype of baptism. So it's a symbolic comparison of the two. And we see that comparison made by it's in Peter, isn't it?
Well, he makes that argument in Romans. He makes the argument about type and antitype in Romans, in Galatians, makes it in, and Peter makes it, Hebrews makes it.
Right.
Yeah, it's an argument that's usually made, where you have the type, which is not the fulfillment. So Adam is the type of Jesus. Jesus is the antitype. He's kind of like the epitome of what the type was.
Right.
Yeah. It's an argument that's frequently made. It's an unfortunate word. It's like, if you're a behaviorist, you have punishment, and you have positive punishment, negative punishment, and positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement. Those are really strange words, and they get my student, when I was teaching, they used to get my students in trouble all the time, because it's just not what it sounds like it ought to be.
Well, it talks about the Antichrist too, and you know that we probably get that mixed up with the antitype. So
yes, right. In that case, it is, because it's referring to Satan, in that case, it is somebody who is against Christ.
Right, yeah.
Boy, this is about as clear as mud.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, that's
all right. I get it, but it's really hard to do that, because I always think of anti as against something. And so you're right that it's hard to separate and really understand it.
Yeah.
I think I get it, though.
Yeah, it's really type and antitype. And it's a confusing analysis. That's why I try not to use it very often, because it gets people, when you try to use that kind of reasoning with people, they run ahead of you and they think they know what antitype means, and they get the wrong meaning for it. Like Ted said.
He believes that you're to say that the Adam, no, not whatever Ted said, was it represents, it's like Jesus, but it's not Jesus, but it's similar to and takes the place of, it's an example.
Yeah, it's an example of
life.
And so Adam is a type of Jesus in that what Adam did affected the whole world. And what Jesus does affected the whole world. So Adam is a type of Jesus. It's a shadow, and Jesus is the substance.
Yeah, they use shadow. Yeah, I've heard that too.
Yeah.
That makes more sense to me.
Yeah. We talk about shadow and substance. It's the same thing as that type and antitype analysis. It's just antitype is an unfortunate word.
Dean?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that it unconfuses me a little more if I think that Adam is the antitype, that he brought sin into the world and all men follow that mold. And Christ is the antitype for us, because when you follow him, everyone who follows him gets life.
Exactly. Exactly. But the way that they correspond, what they brought is very different, but the way that they correspond is, in one man, Adam, sin came into the world. In one man, Jesus, salvation came into the world. So it's the one man that's the characteristic that's so important. It's not what they brought, because they brought something very different, but it's the one man impacting the whole world. That's the argument that the Apostle Paul makes in Romans 5. Even though we had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, we still died. That's what Adam brought into the world.
And I found a better definition. Instead of a Merriam-Webster definition, this is like what the Greek word means. The word type means, first of all, a blow in Greek, and then the mark left by a blow, or the application of pressure. So it uses the example of the mark of the nails left in Christ's hands. So the type is the nail, and the antitype is the mark that was left by it.
Okay.
So it's what you have is a physical rendering, and then you have the fulfillment of that physical rendering. And so you can see that with many of the type and antitype comparisons in the Old and New Testament. You have a physical rendering, a symbol, and then you have the remnant, or the remains of that physical remnant rendering, which is Adam was the physical character, and Jesus, the antitype, was the result of that character.
Right. And he's the spiritual side of it.
Correct.
It's easier to understand the physical than it is the spiritual.
Correct. Yeah.
So a lot of times God gives us the physical thing so that we'll be able to understand what the impact of the spiritual thing is. Yeah, good definition, Ted. Thank you.